Cam Riley and G'day World, rock my fucking world. And this is Thomas from Flagstaff, Arizona, just trying to give a great shout out for the man.
You're listening to the podcast network. Listen, learn, evolve.
G'day, Cam.
Oh, mate, this fucking Skype.
Yeah. I've been trying to send you an SMS, and even that wasn't sending it. What, is the whole of, like, the East Coast gone down or something?
I've been trying to get hold of you for 10 minutes. So how you doing, buddy?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
I'm good, I'm good. I'm fat, though.
Yeah, how do you figure that out?
Well, there's this magazine that's done a story on me, and they've asked me for a photo. And so I had the wife downstairs a little bit earlier taking photos of me, and I was looking at them all going, nah, fat. Nah, too fat. No, too fat. So, you know, I'm just going to send them an email going, nah, sorry, no photos. I'm like a vampire. You cannot take a photo of me.
Use that photo that you uploaded to Flickr, the one where you're tutoring that girl. You're not fat in that.
No, I was 16.
Your hair might have been fat.
I was 16 when I took that, but when someone took that, yeah. Now, you just blew my completely brilliant segue into vampires there. let me do that again.
You've got to prime you for that. Yeah, okay.
Let me do that again. You can't take photos of me. I'm like a vampire.
Wow, vampires. There's an interesting topic.
I'm glad you asked, Rich. Hopeless. But, you know, after all these years we've been working together, you know, 50 years, I thought, you know, we'd have some sort of, you know, secret 50? Signal.
Seems like longer.
I watched Underworld Evolution last night, aka Underworld 2.
I watched that the week before.
There you go. What did you think of it?
I mean, I bought it for one reason. I wanted a, you know, kind of mindless vampire story, and that's what I got.
Yeah. You know, it's not a bad film, but I remember when I saw the first one, you know, I don't know, 6 months ago, I got the first one on DVD and complained at the time that it was, you know, fair enough sort of, you know, schlock thriller action sort of film. But I have this, let me go back. Whenever I watch a vampire movie, I kind of hope that they're going to teach me something about vampires, or at least that they're going to create a believable premise for the existence of vampires that I'm going to walk away from the film going, you know what, that could actually be true. And you know, the next time something goes bump in the night, I'm going to spin around and go, oh, what was that? Before we go any further, let me check the levels. So I just realized I haven't checked the levels. I'll call you back. Hold on.
All right. Hello.
Yeah, that'll do. So I went Wikipediaing vampires last night, and I actually learned some really interesting stuff. Now, I need to share it with someone because I can't even mention the word vampire to Belinda. I went to tell her this morning that I'd read this, and she goes, I can't even mention the name. Can't even mention the word vampires because otherwise she has nightmares about it.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to have to share it with somebody, so I'm going to share it with you guys. Now, it's fascinating stuff. Now, the most fascinating thing is that...
Is this everything you wanted to know about vampires?
This is.
Okay.
Cue the theme music. Right.
We've got theme music?
We will have by the time I edit this show. I'm going to spend the rest of the day looking for theme music for everything you wanted to know about.
So just so the rest of the world understands what just happened there for me. He said, cue the theme music, and then we went silent for about 5 seconds.
That's so I can see on my little thing later where to put it.
I get it, but they might not.
Yeah, you know, screw them. They're not listening anyway. Now, it's just you and me, mate, just you and me. Now, here's everything you ever wanted to know about vampires. Well, I'm going to skip through it, but The interesting thing is that, according to Wikipedia, tales of the dead craving blood are ancient in nearly every culture around the world. Vampire-like spirits called the Lilu are mentioned in early Babylonian demonology, and the blood-sucking Akakaru even earlier in the Sumerian mythology. These female demons were said to... I love the way they're female. These female demons were said to roam during the hours of darkness, hunting and killing newborn babies and pregnant women. I think I went out with one of those once. One of these demons, named Lilitu, was later adapted into Jewish demonology as Lilith, who became Fraser's wife. Lilith is sometimes called the mother of all vampires. The ancient Egyptian goddess Sekhmet, in one myth, became full of bloodlust after slaughtering humans and was only sated after drinking alcohol coloured as blood. In Homer's Odyssey, the shades that Odysseus meets on his journey to the underworld are lured to the blood of freshly sacrificed rams, a fact that Odysseus used to his advantage to summon the shade of Tiresias. Roman tales describe the Strix, a nocturnal bird that fed on human flesh and blood. The Roman Strix is the source of the Romanian vampire, the Strigoi, and the Albanian Striga, which also shows Slavic influence. In early Slavic folklore, a vampire drank blood, was afraid of but could not be killed by silver, and could be destroyed by cutting off its head and putting it between the corpse's legs, or by putting a wooden stake into its heart. There you go. So vampire stories have been around a lot longer than Dracula.
And supposedly Dracula comes from some guy that used to drink blood or something, yeah? That's what I've heard. You always hear about him.
Yeah, well, it comes from a story. But, yeah, there was a guy.
Supposedly, I don't know, somebody important or something like that, yeah?
Yeah, Count Dracula. Let's see what it says about that. Bram Stoker's book, Dracula, in which the Scani Roma served Dracula, blah, 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 the Scani Roma.
So you're not a big fan of, like, you know, the blockbuster type things, and especially probably of Couch Jumping Boy. But what did you think of Interview with a Vampire, the movie?
Yeah, not much, not much. Yeah, you know, I thought, What's-Her-Face, Spider-Man's girlfriend, was quite good in it as a kid.
Yeah, she was fantastic actor.
Yeah, she was good. It had Christian Slater in it. Christian Slater's always good. You know, Christian Slater's one of these guys like Christopher Walken that can pretty much make anything watchable for me.
Yeah.
Just because of that cool accent, you know. Because I'll just always remember him from True Romance saying... You know, I'm not a fag or nothing, but if I ever had the fuck a guy, I mean, if my life depended on it, I'd fuck Elvis. But I actually read one of her books, Anne Rice's books, many, 20 years ago. I read one of her Lestat books, and I kind of liked it, because the thing that I really like about vampire stories is I like the concept of immortality. You know, yeah. You know, I'm a big sucker for immortality, right?
And that's why I was looking for the today's equivalent of Highlander at the time. That's why I picked that movie, because that's what I wanted to watch. I wanted to watch something that talked about, you know, immortals that had been living for centuries and went through a bit of that. That's what I look for when I look for a vampire movie.
Something that gives you a mythology.
Sort
of mythology. So I started working on this last night, and can I just, I'm going to give a plug here for Google Notebook, the first technology reference of the day. I have been using Google Notebook a lot over the last week, and it has now become my primary notebook. Screw, you know, using OneNote or Notepad or Word or anything like that. I just stick it straight in a notebook. It's accessible then from every machine that I'm on. Ideally, it's backed up forever, unless Google goes bye-byes. But it's fantastic. You can just go, you can create new notebooks, you can drag and drop stuff in between notebooks, you can create sections in the notebooks. I mean, it's very simple in terms of the interface, but I like that, you know, and it's very quickly searchable, obviously, being a Google tool. I really like it, man. So I wrote some lengthy notes about vampires last night. And I started to think about, because I'm always thinking about, I want to make a movie, right? I'm always thinking, yeah, if I was going to make a vampire movie, I had to fuck a guy, my life depended on it.
Christopher Walken in it, that's for sure.
No, it would. But I was thinking about the structure that you'd build it around, and I was thinking about all of the key things that you associate with vampires: immortality, drinking blood, supernatural powers, allergic to sunlight, transformational powers. And they bite you, you become a vampire, can only be killed with a stake through the heart, all that kind of stuff. And trying to think, well, you know, what could be some real basis for people exhibiting that? And I thought, okay, let's go. What if around about the same times that humans evolved from apes, what if, by the way, that's a news flash for the Christians out there, we actually evolved from chimpanzees, from the same ancestors. Thank you very much.
Scientists keep proving yet again and again and again and again. Yeah.
I know Darwin was only around 200 years ago, folks, and you're slow readers, but come on, keep up. What if there was, you know, sort of a genetic fork in the road where a new subspecies, either a subspecies of the common parent that we had, or, you know, either humans and vampires had a common parent, or there are subspecies of humans, but there was a number of genetic mutations that happened, one of which gave them immortality in that they don't age. You know, one of the beliefs in when you talk to guys like Aubrey de Grey, who I interviewed last year, who's a scientist who's working on stopping aging, literally stopping aging. Yeah, one of the theories behind aging for the last sort of decade has been focused on these things called telomeres. And I know I've probably talked about this on the show before, certainly when I had Aubrey on. So at the end of your DNA, on either end of your DNA, there's this little stretch of genetic junk code called telomeres.
Sounds like midichlorians, to be honest.
Yes, there are these midichlorians, and if you have a lot of them, then you can...
You're a Jedi.
You can say, these are not the droids you're looking for.
Exactly.
These are not the droids we're looking for.
He can go about his business.
He can go about his business.
Move along.
Move along.
If President Bush had some ability like that, that'd be horrible, wouldn't it?
No, I'm pretty sure he does. Yeah. He stands in front of the White House press corps and says, "You do not have to ask me about Iraq."
We don't have to ask him about Iraq.
Speaking of not asking questions, I want to know, I'll get into this later in the show maybe, I want to know what deal the Australian government, what new deal for access to natural gas reserves the Australian government signs with the East Timorese government in order to send troops in to help them. Yeah, because it was just an amazing coincidence the last time we were in East Timor, you know, finally after something like 20 or 30 years of watching them get slaughtered by the Indonesians, we finally got off our asses and went in there and, you know, liberated them, quote unquote. It was just, you know, a day later that we signed this big natural gas deal that was really good for us. Anyway, quid pro quo, my friends. It's all about quid pro quo. We do for you, you do for us. So anyway, getting back to vampires, what if so there's these telomeres, don't get me confused, Rich, there's these telomeres at the end of DNA, and it's often described, you remember the old magnetic cassette tapes, and at the end of the cassette tape there was this piece of blank tape. Okay, same sort of thing, same sort of concept. And what happens, as I'm sure everyone on listening to this show knows, except the Christians who think that God just makes new little humans, but what actually happens is you have RNA that runs up and down the length of your DNA when the cell is replicating, and it actually basically creates an exact replica, an exact copy of the DNA of the cell, and then that splits into the two cells, and you have a new cell, and the old cell dies, and the new cell goes on. So what happens is each time, if you can imagine a piece of RNA running up the end of the cassette tape, it doesn't get to the very end of the tape, because it stops, you know, a centimetre short of the end of the tape. And so it cuts into that telomere, And after, you know, a couple of hundred replications of the cell, it's actually used up all of that telomere and it starts cutting into the actual DNA and doesn't properly replicate the DNA. There's obviously also, you know, just random errors that happen as it's replicating. But it also, after a couple of hundred replications or whatever it is, it starts cutting into the actual code. Because it stops short. If you think about it, you know, it's got a front leg and a back leg. When the front leg reaches the end of the tape, it stops, but it misses that last centimeter. One of the things that they've been able to do with fruit flies and a few of these sorts of short lifespan animals that they experiment on is to put the cells in a solution called telomerase, which has a lot of telomeres in it. So it keeps adding to the end of those strands of DNA, and the cells and those animals, when they're injected with telomerase, seem to live 100 times longer than they otherwise would. So anyway, this isn't it. So go back and listen to my interview with Aubrey de Grey from last year if you're interested in that kind of stuff in more detail. But the I'm thinking, what if there was this genetic, you know, what's the word? Genetic mutation, thank you very much, that actually caused the RNA to properly copy the DNA every time. So they do actually appear to be immortal. They reach maturity, so you know, they reach the age of 20, and then they stay like that forever, unless they're killed. And then perhaps entwined somewhere in that genetic mutation, there's also one that prevents them from producing hemoglobin. Their body doesn't produce hemoglobin. And so they need to drink blood to get hemoglobin, hemoglobin, or iron or something into their bodies. The only way they can get some really required compound is through drinking the blood of other animals. And then the allergic to sunlight thing could tie into that. Maybe they have this ultra sensitivity to heat and light. They don't go up in smoke and turn to ash like you see in the movies, but maybe they do have, or maybe it was just the fact, or maybe they are, maybe they're sensitive to light. I mean, obviously they were supposedly ran around at the night time and fed on people because they wouldn't be seen, but maybe they did have an allergic reaction to heat or sunlight, as some people do today. And then, and if they bit you and some of their blood, it's not that they bit you, but some of their blood got into your blood, maybe it did take over your blood and caused blood mutations and actually gave you some of the, you know, benefits that they had, if you can call it a benefit.
So this is the first 5 minutes of the movie, right?
Well, I'm thinking of a comic book, actually. I'd like to do a comic book based on...
Online comic book, yeah.
Yeah, an online comic book. I got a couple of ideas. I want to also do an online comic book around sort of 2035 Kurzweil timeline, okay? You know, and AI augmentation of humans and nanotech augmentation and machines achieving sentience and start to explore what's going to happen around about 2030, 2035, what the world's going to look like. The Singularity comic. I'd love to do a Singularity comic. But then I'd love to do a vampire comic as well. Of course, I can't draw for shit. And I can't write for shit. So I need someone to write it and draw it, but I'll do everything else.
You'll read it.
I'm an ideas man. I can't actually do anything, but I have lots of ideas. Oh, speaking of ideas, man, do you ever read T. David's blog?
T. David? No, I don't think I have ever looked at it.
He's got a blog. He's got a blog called Things That Make You Go Hmm, and it's a tech blog, you know, that it's been around for a long time, and I've sort of read it on and off over the years. And he was fairly early into podcasting from a slagging it off perspective. I think about a week after we launched TPN, he started going, "Yeah, but are you making any money yet?" I went like, fuck off, dude. Anyway, he wrote a blog post about Stanek leaving the other day and said, "Oh, you've been running for over a year now, Cameron, you know, how's it doing?" And started saying there were no successful podcasters and nothing's successful. He was basically slagging off podcasting, and I jumped up and I go, "Oh, come on, dude, let me back off." I mean, we're 12 or 18 months into a brand new industry, and you know, I think it's doing quite well as an industry, but it's going to be a while before there's any serious money in it. It's going to take, and he keeps comparing it to AdSense, and I was going, look, dude, AdSense, is building on top of the concept of banner ads, which have been around now since 94. So, you know, we've had 12 years of awareness building and education for advertisers and agencies around the concept of banner ads. Now, you might say AdSense is, you know, context sensitive and all that kind of stuff, but it's just building on top of an appreciation for what a banner ad does. You know, advertising and podcasts is got an education and awareness curve it's got to go through as well. I don't think it's going to take as long as that because the timelines compress with each paradigm shift, but, you know, it's going to take a while. Anyway, this guy, every time I try to, you know, give him a rational explanation for where I think podcasting's at, he just kept calling bullshit on it, and I just got bored with it very quickly. Like, you know, I said something about stumble. I said, you know, after we stumbled into setting up TPN, and he goes, oh, you make it sound like you didn't mean to build a business and, you know, you weren't doing it for a profit motive from day one, and that's bullshit. I'm going, well, actually, dude, no, it's true.
That happened.
You remember what it was like. We were like, oh, yeah, a couple of you guys want to do a podcast? We're doing a podcast. Do you want to do a podcast? That'd be cool, huh? We had no idea.
He should grab that. I can't remember actually the content of it, but there was a video early on where you guys were sitting down talking about it, and that was when you actually incorporated the business, and that was like months afterwards, right?
Six months afterwards,
because previous to that, it was like, well, the G'day World was just a, you know, you guys and self-admitted said that it was basically just making it easier for you guys to have a conversation that you normally had in a coffee shop when you met each other within the cities that you both lived, all right?
It was exactly the Skype call that we would have once a week, sort of catching up on the news, and we just recorded it and put it out there, really. And, but with TPN, there was really no grand plan from day one. It was just like, hey, this podcasting thing's cool, and we'd like to do more, but, you know, there's all these technology sort of hurdles back then, and let's get a couple of guys together and see if we'd all do some shows together. Anyway, there was no grand plan, really. If there was, we would have actually put something in writing very early on. Yeah, that's another story. So that's my vampire story. Anyway, enough of that bullshit.
Speaking
I started
vampires,
thinking too much about vampires last night. Yeah. What's Tim O'Reilly got to say today?
Yeah, that's exactly where I wanted to go. I just wanted a little segment on it because I got hours of amusement over the story, more amusement over the story over the weekend. So we talked about it on Friday where Web 2.0 has been service marked by CMP, I think it is, which is a partner of O'Reilly. And anyway, Tim's on holiday until I think Tuesday US time, and so he's not around to talk. And so I don't think there'd been a response from O'Reilly, as in the company O'Reilly Media, at the time we talked last. And, of course, since then they've actually responded, or at least the PR person or somebody stuck their foot in it even further by responding and saying that, you know, this is just what you do with service marks. You meant to defend them, otherwise there's no point in having them. And oh, we've granted them the use of the word on this occasion. And of course, then the blogosphere erupts and everybody's posting comments on the blog saying what a stupid idea it is. And I guess that the people that are arguing within O'Reilly for the service mark are missing the idea behind it. It's so contradictory to have a service mark or any type of proprietariness around Web 2.0, A, because it's a generic term in my belief, and B, because the whole, you know, underpinning of Web 2.0 is that it's open and community driven and, you know, everybody sort of is looking after each other, and this kind of goes against all of that. But yeah, it's great fun reading all of the comments and all the blog posts, and the only thing that I think I've seen that's been as big as this is probably the latest news about Apple losing its bid to sue or to get a blogger to reveal
who
their source was. Both seem to have gotten about the same amount of publicity, but it'll be interesting to see what Tim O'Reilly has to say when he's back on board on Tuesday.
you can just imagine Tim getting back and going, I'm never taking a holiday again.
Well, apparently, yeah, he's totally off the grid, so no mobile phone, no nothing. So
He's going to come back to the biggest shitstorm.
He'll be on his way back, and all of a sudden he'll realise it's been... I mean, I've only known Ali for probably 10 years and probably only been serious about monitoring what they do for the last several. But certainly this has got to be the biggest PR blue that they've, you know, made.
Hmm. So, yeah, so the one of their... Nick Kubrilovich has left a comment on the O'Reilly Radar blog. Nick, our mate Nick, says, not the sort of response we were all waiting for. I was hoping to hear that it was a mistake, but it seems that O'Reilly will be going after anybody who tries to set up any conference around Web 2.0. Well, using that exact phrase. Linux World is the name of a complete brand, very different, because the Sarah Winge... the
it's
unfortunate
like Dave Winer.
Winer, isn't it? Who's the VP of Corporate Communications at O'Reilly, who wrote their sort of defense post up on the Radar blog. She says something in there about, it would be like us going setting up a Linux World conference. No, it's completely different to that, Sarah. It's got... Anyway, Nick says, it's very different. The analogy there would be if somebody tried to set up an O'Reilly conference. Certainly not the case here.
Hmm.
Just like we should be able to set up a Linux Apache open source conference, we should be able to set up a Web 2.0 conference. It's not your brand. You didn't build it. The community did. All very ironic. Good on you, Nick.
The beauty of O'Reilly's response so far has been exactly everything someone like Scoble and was it Shell Israel who wrote the book
Shell
Major Conversation. Shell, both of those guys. I mean, Shell I know has already actually mentioned what a mess he thinks it is, but it's exactly the kind of response that they would say you don't do within the blogosphere. They had a PR person who didn't respond personally on the blog. They kind of cut and paste a response saying, oh, but she doesn't have access to the blog, and we don't think it's appropriate that we give her access for this particular instance. She responds by saying that there's no real apology. You know, all they do is kind of say, oh, you know, look, we'll allow you to have it for this particular conference. I think they've sent another letter to this guy, faxed it to him saying, you can, here you go, sign this, which basically says, yes, you can use it, but we promise never ever to use Web 2.0 ever again for any of our conferences. And just the whole way they've responded has been classic, you know, non-blogosphere, non-community driven, you know, the whole sort of stuff that everybody in the blogosphere says you just don't do. And it's just bizarre coming from O'Reilly, because they're a company that you think are pretty in touch.
Yeah, I'm fascinated actually that Steve Rubell doesn't seem to have commented on it.
Well, here's the interesting thing. The people that... there's a click that are involved with O'Reilly, the people on the in with the O'Reilly group. And somebody actually called out Cory Doctorow, who hadn't responded apparently because he was on holiday. However, his response, in my opinion, is fairly, you know, it's kind of like just being a bit gentle about it, which is exactly not Corey, right? When Corey sees something that he believes is just wrong, especially when it comes to the law, he's very vocal about it, and yet his response was kind of, you know, just being very gentle, which is fine because he's got a relationship with these guys. And my actual thoughts are he should have come out and said, look, I got a relationship with O'Reilly. I do a lot of work with him. I probably shouldn't comment is kind of how I feel he should have responded, because he's too close to it, you know. And there's been, you know, John Battell, who's actually responsible for part of the Web 2.0 thing, came out very cautiously as well, which is, his response was actually quite good in that he was cautious, saying, I'm very close to it, I'm waiting for Tim to come back. But there's a whole bunch of other people that are fairly big with respect to O'Reilly, and they're always at the conferences and get invited to speak. And there's been a few people sort of saying, noticing some people that aren't making, you know, any comments at this point in time.
Hmm. Yeah, I see Scoble's made a brief mention of it, quoting Rick Siegel, who says that CMP and Tim O'Reilly are taking over Scoble's King Evil spot. But Scoble's mum passed away a couple of days ago, so obviously he's offline and not very involved in the blogosphere, as well he should be not. But our commiserations to Robert and his family. Yeah, but you're right. I mean, there's it's very unusual for certain people not to be up in arms. I don't know why Rubell. I don't know that Rubell is that in with O'Reilly, but
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's isn't it a long weekend over there at the moment?
Oh,
I think it is.
Okay.
So there's probably a bunch of people offline. Rick Siegel's one was brilliant. I loved his response, and I thought his was hilarious just reading through it. What was one of it? Finally, an exercise for the reader. For some fun and homework, grab the list of O'Reilly conference speakers and friends of O'Reilly campers found around the internet. Cross-reference those people's blogs via Ice Rocket to see how many of them step up and smack O'Reilly over the rather aggressive IP protection move. You won't find many. You won't find tons of people boycotting O'Reilly books or conferences. The reason? Brand. Tim has personally been the true good guy face of this company, and you can be sure that he is no dummy. Barring a massive overdose of stupid pills, Tim will step up, own it, and give an apology slash explanation that will calm people down. In my view, a bunch of over-eager corporate types will get a what-the-fuck, or, you know, WTF, wet noodle beating, and the rest of us will see a smart business owner take responsibility for this oopsie. I would expect nothing less. Hope the vacation was relaxing, Tim. His response basically said that the people that have so far commented from O'Reilly have just not taken any blame, and it's kind of been a finger-pointing exercise, and just a great read. Funny stuff.
Have you read what Shel Israel wrote?
I did, but refresh my memory.
Shel, we should try and get Shel on. Let me see if he's on Skype. I'll try and Skype bomb him. No, wouldn't you believe it? The one time he's not on. Bugger. Scoble? No, Scoble's not on either, which is fair enough. Who else? Anyone? Anyway. So whoops, shit. Didn't mean to press that link. So, Shel wrote a post called "Let's Call It Web Blah Blah Blah." This is his post. When censors forced Lenny Bruce to either not say certain words or face jail, he started using the phrase blah blah blah, where those words would actually go. It made his nightclub acts even funnier and more devastating than they had been. I'm sitting here facing a deadline of tomorrow for sending my PowerPoint presentation to IT at Cork, who earlier today received a cease and desist order not to use the words web 2 blah 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 as the name of the conference. I am to deliver a speech on what web 2 blah 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 is about and how web 2 blah 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 will change communities, companies, and the world in general. The ironic twist is that my very first slide will quote a bunch of influencers who each say the term is hype, inaccurate, and deceptive. The second slide was going to cite one Tim Riley as the source and author of the word, then say Tim is of Irish extraction, and we all know what great storytellers the Irish are. Another slide was going to mention generosity as one of the key characteristics of this web blah 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 world we are now entering into. It's obvious I need a rewrite. Blah 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 blah. And if the CMP lawyers don't like it, they can all kiss my blah blah blah. Good on you, Shelby. Shell's a great guy. I tell you a little story. The first time I ever met Shell, I was at demo in Arizona early last year, and it was sort of the day before the conference, and we're in the hotel in Scottsdale, Arizona, and I'm standing there with Buzz and I think, I don't know, Scoble hadn't arrived yet, but we're talking to a few people. Buzz is sort of introducing me to a few guys, and he says, "This is Shel Israel," and Shel and I, so I do the g'day, and Shel says, "I'm going to go get a coffee. Does anyone want a coffee?" And I said, "You got any real coffee here or just that Starbucks shit?" And he said, "Don't you've been in our country for like 12 hours and you're already bagging the coffee?" And I said, "Well, yeah, if you can't really call it coffee, man, this is, you Americans," and we got into this huge blue over coffee, and he just started getting down on me big time. He started slapping me for in their coffee, and I started telling him how Americans, you know, coffee tastes like piss, and you know, that was how Shel and I got to know each other. But he's a great guy. He and I hang out at conferences now. He's a very cool dude.
He just
dude.
Doesn't buy you any coffee, obviously.
Nah, it's a running joke now. Running joke with me and Shel on the coffee. But he's a very cool dude. He's a funny guy. He's like, Shel reminds me of somebody that would have worked in vaudeville. 100 years ago, you know. He's you know, a little sort of Jewish guy with a beard, and he never stops talking, and he's very animated, and he's, if you sit, whatever you do, if you ever go to a conference and you're in the blogging table, don't sit next to Shell, because he does not shut the hell up. He talks non-stop to you all through a conference. He just doesn't shut up.
Background an author, or is he...
No. He's what he calls a recovering PR hack.
Okay.
So he was in PR. I did an interview with him. Go back and check the G'day World archives. We had him on the show a year ago or so. And his big claim to fame, probably one of the biggest things that he did, was when they launched the first sound cards. Who were the company that owned the sound card thing back in the 90s?
Sound Blasters.
Yeah, I think it might have been Sound Blaster. When they had like the first ones that were coming out, he had the PR gig for them, and you know, he talks about how they were trying to get the New York Times or somebody to cover it, and they took a PC with one of these sound cards in it, carried the whole damn PC into the New York Times, set it up in the boardroom, and the journo said, yeah, you got 5 minutes, the tech journo. And they turned on, I don't know, Jimi Hendrix or something, and just started playing the music through the PC. And he said, these people from all over the floor, all over the journalists, all came over to see what the hell was going on, and they couldn't believe that this music was coming through a PC. He was pretty pleased with that. Anyway,
nice.
Lots of other stories. So, yeah, O'Reilly's are screwing that up big time. As you say, it's a classic case of what not to do. And it just, you know, you would expect that to come from a clueless company. You would not expect it to come from O'Reilly's.
Well,
they're the last people.
You just expect them to release a book next week on, you know, what not to do, and they go, ah, yes, we've just, you know, all the last week's just been an exercise in publicity. We're just doing a demonstration in how not to do shit these days.
That's right. There's some other interesting news. Obviously, you mentioned about the Apple loss. We should talk about that in some detail because that's kind of important news. So,
very important news, yeah.
This is from Ars Technica. It says, a California appeals court judge has ruled in favor of a petition filed by the EFF. I hope that's hurt somebody's ears. EFF, good on you guys. That frustrates Apple's attempt to force rumor sites Apple Insider and PowerPage to reveal their sources. In 2004, website Apple Insider published an exclusive account of a new Apple product alleged to be in development, a breakout box for GarageBand dubbed Asteroid, presumably because it allowed you to rock. Rimshot. The ruling concludes that trade secrets do not categorically transcend freedom of the press, that there is no relevant legal distinction between journalistic blogging and journalism with regards to the Shield Law, and that Apple's attempt to subpoena the email service provider of one of the sites was a violation of the Federal Stored Communications Act. So that's a major ruling. The impact of that will be seen far and wide.
So most people everybody in the US will understand, everybody outside the US will probably understand too, because we've all seen it on TV and movies, but basically a journalist doesn't have to divulge their source because of the First Amendment, because, you know, everybody has a right to speak about this stuff, and so therefore they don't have to divulge. But Apple was saying, no, you know, because you're just a blog, just being the operative word, you have to tell us who your source is so we can sue them. And as it turns out, they have no right to do that, which is fantastic, because everybody at the time was saying, no, look, blogging is the same. We should be able to have the First Amendment protection that, you know, journalists do, because we're doing the same job, just, you know, it's called something different. So it's fantastic that they've won that.
So the history, well, I suspect it's not over yet.
No,
I suspect
it's a good
it'll be
step,
more.
Right?
Yeah,
it's,
so
it's never one, right? I mean, there's always bloody another court that they've got to go to.
Yeah. So in March 2005, there was a Superior Court judge, James Kleinberg, who issued a decision in favor of Apple, asserting that the legal protections conferred upon journalists by the First Amendment and the California Shield Law do not imbue reporters with the right to disseminate trade secrets divulged to them by others. So it's not just about bloggers versus journalists. There's also this question of, you know, whether or not you can divulge trade secrets. But the EFF appealed that ruling, suggesting that coerced disclosure of journalistic sources would silence potential whistleblowers by depriving them of the ability to remain anonymous, pointing out that important information about dangerous products could be obscured from public scrutiny by the excessive application of trade secret laws. The EFF argued that Apple shouldn't be allowed to arbitrarily silence journalists when the company had failed to pursue due diligence and internal investigation. Under the interpretation of the First Amendment, subpoenas necessitating disclosure of a journalist's source are supposed to be used only when no other means of attaining the relevant information are available. So you can still silence a journalist, but you have to have proven that you've gone through your own backyard first. And it says here the EFF hoped to demonstrate that Apple had not conducted their own investigation in good faith. Now, in September of 2005, additional evidence emerged to support the EFF's claim that Apple had failed to internally investigate the leak before initiating legal action, a distinctly ironic revelation in light of the fact that Apple had attempted to deflect examination of its internal investigatory policies by claiming that the procedures used in their investigations were themselves trade secrets. That's a nice one. Oh, damn. Apple is increasingly looking evil, aren't they?
They are. They are. I mean, the only thing that's saving them is the fact that they do really nice products, right? But as soon as they slip up, and, you know, they always well, they can't keep going forever making products that people really like, they're going to really struggle because their mentality is not to particularly look after their customers or their fans.
Yeah. So I'm sure we'll see some additional fallout from that, but I'm sure there'll be, you know, appeals and appeals and appeals and appeals and appeals and appeals.
But it's a good example of why everybody should get out there and support the EFF. EFF.org.
I also want to read a thing that Steve Gilmore wrote in his blog. I met Steve once, New York last year. Nice guy. Had us up to his balcony in New York for a party. But I've got to read this just because he slaps Paul Montgomery. And Paul Montgomery is the world's worst link baiter.
Really?
Have you ever met Paul?
No.
Melbourne boy, ex-journalist, now runs a startup called Tin Finger, mate of Ben Barron's.
You know. I remember you having a chat with him.
Yeah, he just slags. He likes slagging people off as a means of link baiting. And Gilmore writes, first Dave Weiner highlights the one sentence in this blog that actually seemed to sound positive. You know, the angry old man, etc. Then a spate of crap from the trolls highlighted by one Paul Montgomery, a down-under journalist, his word, who slimes all US journalists on his way to getting at me, not a journalist. So Dan Farber, Dana Gardner and Doc Searles recalled the latest, still another one in the can from last week, Gilmore Gang, and the usual strategy breaks down big time. Instead of some witty banter and office's deadness, the whole thing becomes my indictment of Tim O'Reilly's CMP Web 2.0 injunction by extension Esther Dyson, Kevin Supernova, and the whole lousy business of tech conferences and the girls that don't attend them. The mood turns quite turgid. Farber points out that I've gone too far, actually making some enemies in the process. I lamely try and explain that it's nothing personal. But of course it is, and even Doc finally accuses me of trying to manipulate him into saying bad things. I got to go listen to this episode of The Gilmore Game.
Well, it's not out yet, but yeah, it's because they're always a week or so behind, so I think that's what his comment when he said something about it being in the can is. It's they've recorded it, he's just yet to release it. But yeah, I agree, I want to listen to it.
So they're also suggesting here that The Gilmore Game might be over.
But I spoke to Steve last year on the Gadget Show about attention and stuff like that, because he's a big proponent of it. And I had a conversation with him. In fact, I think it was probably about the podcasting book. I had a particular conversation that I don't think I released, and he wasn't sounding particularly happy. I think he goes through phases where he considers, you know, just dumping the whole podcasting thing and stuff like that. I think that's just part of Steve's cycle.
Yeah, he strikes me as one of those guys. So the final paragraph he has here is, So, in the spirit of recent network upfronts, the demise of the West Wing, but its replacement with West Wing / Friends, Washington with Beautiful People mashup, and various other interesting gestures yet to be hinted at, the Gilmore Gang is going on hiatus, to be replaced for the summer by the Gilmore Gang Presents Attention Deficit Theatre, starring Doc Searls, Jason Calacanis, Dan Farber, and whoever else remembers the phone number and passcode or uses Gmail. I know Dan Farber too. Met Dan. Nice guy. Doc, Jason, and Dan, my three mates. So what else have we got on the buzzer today, mate?
Somebody's talking, well, there's been a little bit of talk about Google and a new thing that's been found within the code of Google. I'm not sure whether it's just within the search code or not.
Yeah, the prices thing. But screw that. The most important Google news is the Dell deal.
Yeah, very big news. And I'd like to be a fly on the wall inside of Microsoft.
So for those that haven't read it, Google and Dell have agreed to a first in a series of deals to pre-install web and desktop search software on the PC maker's computers, Eric Schmidt, Google CEO, said on Thursday. So the number one PC maker, Dell and Google, have got a deal where they're going to pre-install some stuff. Their Dell PCs are going to be loaded with Google Toolbar for web and PC search, along with a co-branded homepage before they're shipped. Now, okay, that's good. What about when they start shipping? Well, I don't know. There's nothing else to ship, really. Google Desktop Search, is that what they're going to ship?
I admittedly didn't read it properly, but I assumed they were going to be shipping some of the Google Desktop stuff.
Well, when they say toolbar, I automatically think of a browser toolbar, but what browser are they going to put? An IE browser toolbar, I guess, perhaps. But it could be the desktop search stuff, which would be even more powerful. They don't really, but this is the interesting deal. Financial details were not disclosed, but Schmidt said the companies will share revenue from search advertising fees. Mm-hmm. So we've talked about this on the show before, kids. You know, the idea of the Google desktop, where Google says to the OEMs. Now, obviously, you know, the history with OEMs is for 30 years or for 20 years anyway. Microsoft has had deals with the computer manufacturers, OEMs as they're known in the industry, original equipment manufacturers, for those of you who aren't in the PC business, that means that the OEMs need to pay Microsoft money for every PC that they ship for the right to carry Windows on the PC. And, you know, margins being what margins are in the PC business these days, every dollar counts, right? There's not a lot of margin in the PC game. It's very much become a volume game in the last decade. Now, what Google now have the potential to do is to say, well, we'll give you this free software, plus we'll cut you in on a share of the advertising revenue that you generate by putting our software on your PC. So it actually could make money for the OEMs, which is just, you know, a massive change of paradigm for the OEMs. They could actually make money by putting this stuff on.
Which is, you know, unless you've kind of looked into it, I guess there's a lot of people that wouldn't realize what's happening with respect to search and advertising and search bars and stuff like that. But the interesting thing is a lot of people are actually supporting their business by those types of methods, like Firefox and some of the other sort of web browsers. So if you're surprised that there's a bunch of little web browsers that keep popping up and you're going, why in the world would you do that? Because, you know, it seems like such a saturated market, or, you know, Internet Explorer's got it sewn up. The general idea is that if in your, say, Firefox, for example, if you use Firefox's search bar and do a search within that, they actually get paid by the search engine that they're using. So it's actually supporting a number of different businesses and sort of, you know, thinking outside of the box. Now, what I was just trying to look up, I was doing a bit of research for business plans and stuff.
While you, while you looking that up, let's have a listen to Eric Schmidt talk about the deal. This is from the Goldman Sachs internet conference on Thursday.
In fact, we have signed the deal, and it's a big, big deal for both companies. What we've done is with Dell, we have a multi-year deal. They're going to take the Google Toolbar and the Google Desktop, Circle Desktop 4, and a number of other of our search and information applications, and put them into every Dell consumer, small, medium, and large enterprise product that they can. It's tens of millions of computers a year. I'll let them go into the details of the numbers, but it's a worldwide deal. It's a really, really big deal for both companies. And I think very, very good for them, very, very good for us. And, you know, we've been in this trial with them for about 6 months, so we really understand the economics well. We understand the value that it provides. And the real reason to do this, by the way, is the end user benefit. Because it fixes a whole bunch of problems with how people have out-of-the-box Dell experiences in a really, really interesting way. Well, we're partnering on the advertisements. There's a number of things about common home pages and service levels. We have a working team that will, you know, work out various extensions. And there's probably more to come, right, this is the first probably of a series of such deals with Dell. The company is focused on end users first. And end users, we've been in this industry so long, we forget what it's like to be a normal person who doesn't really use computers all the time. And one of the nice things about the Dell deal is you turn the Dell machine on, and they've always been known for ease of use, right? One of their strengths, telephone models and all that. And everything's right there. Everything's up. It's all integrated with respect to search within the Dell computer. If it's sold within an enterprise, it will also be integrated with search within the enterprise. So it's essentially a turnkey solution for search and for information in general.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing stuff. So it's a multi-year deal. It's going to be integrated with all their consumer PCs, whether they're for consumer, for the individual, right up through the enterprise, small, medium, and enterprise deals. This is a big, big thing.
And if people are sort of sitting there going, yeah, it can't be much money in it. So Google's profit in 2005, this is profit, was $3.56 billion. Now, if you go into any great detail, you'll find that Google has basically two business models, search services and advertising. And I'm trying at the moment to actually find, not for this particular show, but just in general to find out, you know, what the split is. But from what I can gather, the split is definitely weighted towards the advertising, as in they make more money out of the advertising than the search services. So, you know, we're talking, you know, probably over 1.5, you know, probably looking at 2 billion or so in advertising profit. So there's significant money to be made, and that's growing, of course. Each quarter, Google is seeing that grow significantly.
Now, on the same day that this news came out, and we got the news about Yahoo and eBay doing an advertising deal that we talked about on Friday, there's this news come out in the New York Post that says that Microsoft has been in discussions with eBay for several weeks about acquiring eBay. Now, apparently the discussions are still ongoing, but have cooled somewhat in the last 2 weeks, as executives considered antitrust issues, and then obviously the Yahoo deal would add another level of complexity to that deal. But, you know, these sorts of conversations, I think, go on all the time between companies of this size. They're always, you know, catching up for a drink and going, well, what if we did X, Y, and Z, you know?
Yeah, and Microsoft will probably be looking at a bunch of different deals for web services companies, because, you know, that's sort of the direction that they've stated that they're heading now. They're looking at making money out of advertising on the internet.
Yeah, it's been interesting in the last year. Obviously, some of you will remember that last year Microsoft was trying to do a deal with Time Warner that would have combined AOL and MSN together. And they lost out to Google. Google pipped them in the deal. Now it comes out that Microsoft's been trying to do a deal with eBay, but it would seem that they may have lost that to Yahoo. So who's left? Amazon? They're based in Seattle. It's a good... But, I mean, who else has Microsoft got? Yahoo and eBay have paired up. You know, Google and AOL paired up. Google's just paired up with Dell.
PayPal's already owned.
Out of the Jumia, if you look at the Jumia people that sort of own all the world's traffic, Microsoft and News Corp, maybe Bill and Rupert will come out with a deal.
Yeah.
All right. I know what you're thinking, but we won't go there. la, 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 la. Oh, look, I think that's about an hour, man. That's enough. That's a day. Cool. We didn't get to talk much about East Timor, but, you know, all I suggest, people, is that there's a quid pro quo involved whenever we send troops into any country, be it Iraq, be it East Timor, you name it. You don't go sending troops in just out of the goodness of your heart. There's always a sting in the tail. And it'll be interesting to see what kind of deals we get out of East Timor. You know, don't forget when you see everything on the 6 o'clock news that there is some terrific natural gas reserves in East Timor that they've got access to, you know, and that they did a deal with Australia around. In the Timor Sea, there are vast reserves of oil and natural gas worth tens of billions of dollars that, according to international treaties and where the borders of these countries are out in the water, belong to East Timor. And Australia wants to get their hands on those, which is one of the reasons you've seen a lot of violence in East Timor over the last few years, and one of the reasons why Australians' armies have been involved. It was so we could get access to some of the money. Now, you know, you always hear of the East Timorese government described as cash-strapped. One of the reasons they've had this outbreak of violence in the last week is because they were going to sack almost half the country's military. And the military went on strike to protest poor conditions and pay. And there's a lot of ethnic tension over there as well. But a lot of it has got to do with where the money's going, who's got the money, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and it is significant. I mean, there's and a lot of what Australia is riding on at the moment is selling gas to China, places like that. So it's significant, you know, for Australia. In that respect.
Yeah, so we went into West Timor to help separate them from Indonesia a couple of years ago, and there were some great oil and gas deals that came out of that. Now, these aren't, you know, we're going in there backed by the UN in this case. In 1999, there was the sort of the pro-Indonesian militia that was after an independence vote. Well, they were arguing against the independence vote back then, and we sent troops in to try and smooth things over, but we got a nice little gas deal out of that. And, you know, this country should be receiving a lot of money from the oil and gas reserves that it's got off the coast. So it's a melting pot.
It is.
60% of its population in East Timor are illiterate. 60% of its population of 925,000 people. Imagine that. They reckon the oil and gas reserves are worth up to $14.5 billion. Now, you can be sure that there's a lot of countries that are going to be trying to get their share of that. You know, and how much of it is going to go to the people who live in East Timor? Yeah. You know, it's like the same thing you see. You know, this is what's going on in places like Venezuela, where they've got all these oil reserves in Venezuela that have been mined for the last 20, 30 years. But have the people of Venezuela seen the benefits of that money? No, it's all gone offshore. And that's why you've had Hugo Chavez come along and go, actually, we're going to privatize it all and keep it all within the country so we can educate the people and provide them with health care and, you know, raise the standard of living. But all of the countries like the US that had made claims on those oil reserves are now getting pissed off and starting to call him a commie. So in order for us to get the sort of outcome that we want in a country like East Timor, you need to have a leader like what's the name of the guy who's the leader there at the moment who's invited our troops in?
Oh, don't ask me.
Shoshana Gushmel, the Timorese foreign minister is Jose Ramis Horta, but you need to have political leaders that are willing to invite foreign interests in and in return do deals that'll send a lot of the wealth that belongs to the country back out to those foreign countries. So just keep an eye out in the news over the coming months as, you know, the East Timorese situation settles down for news about oil and gas deals that Australia has signed, and you'll know why we're really sending troops in there now. Don't believe we give a shit about the ethnic disturbances that are happening. We don't care. It was going on for 30 years. We didn't bat an eyelid. All of a sudden, we've decided we wanted the oil and gas, and now we're helping out. Now we're being the good guys. All right. That's it. Got nothing else?
Nah, that's it today. We did pretty good for a Monday. Usually there's bugger all news, but there was plenty of controversy over the weekend.
And, you know, we put a call out to people to go up and vote for us on Friday, and 22 people did. So, and I think that's about our entire listenership. So thank you very much to those 22 people. The five of you, I think we've got about 27. So for the five of you who didn't vote, you suck. But for the 22 people who did go up and vote, yeah, good on ya. I had a look. The number one show in Podcast Alley at the moment, which is, I think, a tech TV thing, has 1,300 votes, I think, for the month of May. So we got close with our 22. We got close. A couple more, we would have probably cracked the back of it. But
yeah. The breaking point, tipping point, we've just got to reach. Yes. Probably 23, and worry, we're they just are, on the downhill.
They're keeping an eye on us. They fear us now. No, mate. Have a good one.
You too.
Hello, everyone. Tom Allen here, host of The Jazz Show on the Podcast Network. If you want to hear some soulful, swinging, smooth jazz, The Jazz Show is where it's at. I have a reserve spot waiting just for you. Stop by at jazz.thepodcastnetwork.com.